I'll sort of review it in a moment as well. The main takeaway, I hope, in terms of why I'm going through all this symmetry is, again, that there's a sort of naive dimensional estimate for the size of any operator in the standard model. But we want to understand which operators are actually smaller than the naive estimate in the standard model, because those are the operators that we then have sensitivity that enable us to probe much higher mass scales, right? So if the coefficient in the standard model is much less than, say, G2 squared over MW squared, which is a sort of typical size of operator that you might have expected in the standard model, then you can look for CBSM, it's greater than or of order C standard model. That would be an order one effect, but that could be of order G2 squared, say, sorry, there's some shadow on the text. G2 squared over M nu squared, where M nu is much greater than the mass of the W. So the way to find physics at high energy scales through these indirect effects is by focusing on the things that are smaller than your naive expectation in the standard model. And the way you can get something like this is by an exact or approximate symmetry. And so we need to understand those symmetries in order to figure out what are the places to look for this new physics and to really understand the standard model part. So that's what I started doing last time. We talked about the symmetry of the standard model in the limit that you ignore every single Yukawa coupling, and you ignore the charged interactions, the interactions of the charged W's. And this, somebody asked me after class about this G2, you know, plus or minus, is it the same coupling? What's the deal with the plus or minus? It's really a little artificial. We could just talk about sending G2 to zero, but I do, at the same time, I want to emphasize that for finite G2, non-zero G2, it's still the case that the Z interactions, the charged or the neutral part of the W interactions, that continues to respect all seven of these symmetry groups. It's only the charged W interactions controlled by the same G2, but just the charged part that actually break the symmetry down in the case of the quark to a U3 that treats the up-type left-handed quarks and the down-type left-handed quarks the same way, and in the case of the leptons to a U3 that treats the charged leptons and the neutrinos, the left-handed ones, in the same way. Whereas the neutral W's respect the whole U3 to the seventh symmetry. So that's why I'm distinguishing the G2 plus or minus, because as we think about the symmetry breaking, it's important to remember that you need charged W's in town in order to get that symmetry breaking. A neutral Z in a diagram, the diagram needs to have W's in order, charged W's in order to break the symmetry. Now, we also looked at what the Yukawas did, taken one at a time. And each Yukawa coupling singles out basically a mass eigenstate basis as a sensible basis, right? If I have a general coupling, I'll do Y up. So if I have a general coupling in my Lagrangian, which looks like U conjugate right, some I index, lambda up, ij, u left, times the Higgs-Vev, after electroweak symmetry breaking, I can always write lambda up ij as being equal to, I can decompose it into an eigenvalue decomposition, right? There's always some v left, or I should call him v u right dagger, because he's acting on the right-handed guys. Lambda u tilde ij. Well, sorry, I'm just doing matrix math. So just as a matrix, lambda is that v times lambda tilde times some v you left, where this lambda tilde is a diagonal matrix. And then I can take these aren't necessarily the same matrix, by the way. They would be the same matrix if this lambda were Hermitian, but it doesn't have to be. It's an arbitrary 9x9 complex matrix, arbitrary 3x3 complex matrix, fortunately, with 9 complex entries. So you need different left and right rotations, but that's fine. We have two different symmetry groups here that we can use. We can absorb that. We can define now our u right tilde I to be equal to u right I, u right j times v dagger u right j I. Right? And then we can define u left j to be v u left jk u left k. I'm being pretty slow. I'm using up and down indices the same way here. I'm just denoting matrix multiplication. Although one can, it's often useful to keep track of fundamental and anti-fundamental indices. But here I'm just being indiscriminate with them. So I can do, this should be tilde. I can do that field redefinition. And I want to also just emphasize, this is something that doesn't affect the Lorentz indices at all. Right? These I's and J's and K's, they are just labeling the three vector up, charm, top, or in the case of the down-type quarks, the three-vector down-strange bottom. And mixing those three flavors, no effect on the spinner indices, no effect on SU2 indices. Those are just flavor indices. So by doing that field redefinition, this would then be precisely equal to, I want these v's the other way. If I put this in, then I can rewrite my Lagrangian as being equal to u tilde right conjugate lambda up tilde u left, right? And all the intermediate v's cancel there, and times v. And so then, keep forgetting my tildes on the left hand, guys. So then these are the mass eigenstate basis. These lambda tilde components are the mass eigenvalues. And the symmetry that remains after I've fixed this, the symmetry that leaves this special form invariant where lambda tilde just has diagonal and, by the way, also real elements. So lambda's diagonal and real, the only thing that preserves that form is this u1 cubed, where I take u right I, or let me actually write this out in terms of the three flavors, to e to the I alpha 1, e to the I alpha 2, e to the I alpha 3 times the same thing. And if I defined this matrix to be M, okay, of alpha 1, of the alphas, then I'd want to also simultaneously, to keep these eigenvalues real, I need to simultaneously transform the u's. Right? And what I need to do is I need to transform the u's, the lefts, to m dagger, which here is just the complex conjugate times themselves. So that transformation right? What I'm doing is I'm using the symmetry group to bring this large unwieldy 3x3 matrix. So that has 9 complex numbers in it, or which we can call 9 real numbers and 9 phases. 2, just a real mass to just a real set of mass eigenvalues. 3 real mass eigenvalues. And something you'll notice, and in the process, we've also, once we fix that, we have less symmetry available to us because most of the symmetries would take us out of that form. This always has the property, that manipulation always has the property that the number of sort of bogus, so some of the point is some of these parameters in lambda weren't really physical. They were just choices of the basis. I can change them by choices of basis. The invariant physical content of lambda is those 3 real eigenvalues. So I've gone from 9 real numbers plus 9 phases of original content to 3 physical real numbers. How did I do that? In the process, I broke 2 U3 groups. So I broke U3, you write across U3, you left, down to a U1 cubed. Okay, now you know SU3 has 8 generators, U3 has 9 generators. So this has 9 generators, this has another 9 generators, this has 3 generators. The fact that this is 9, this is 18 generators, this is 18 real numbers, this is 3 generators, 3 real numbers, that's an accident. But what's always true is, let's say I broke. Here, what this means is that I broke spontaneously, if you will, by adding lambda. By adding lambda to the theory, broke 15, 18 minus 3. Symmetries. Those 15 broken symmetries allow me to make 15 choices. Each one corresponds to a choice of simplification in my lambda matrices. And so the number of unphysical things that I removed from the initial lambdas to my final set of mass eigenvalues has to be equal to the number of broken symmetries. So the fact that I have 15 broken symmetries implies that this 9 to 9 plus 9 should be reduced to just 3 pieces of physical information. You have to be a little careful with this argument, because on some level, how did you know how many symmetries were broken? Well, you knew by seeing what was the simplest way of, you know, you had to figure out that there were 3 U1s left over. If you hadn't realized that there were 3 U1s left over, you would have thought you had less physical information at the end of the day. So this is most useful as a consistency check that you've done your math right, that the number of symmetries you've broken should always equal the number of unphysical degrees of freedom that you remove from your parameters. And we can think of this. We can actually do one better than this, because here I've just kept track of total generators. I'm not keeping track of whether they're getting rid of real numbers or getting rid of phases. You can actually keep track of both. So if I look at a U3, here I went from 9 real plus 9 phases to 3 physical real numbers. So what we want to understand is what kind of symmetry breaking in terms of real and imaginary generators do we gives us that. This is, I always find this slightly confusing because when I think about the generators, I'm thinking about a unitary matrix being equal to e to the I times a Hermitian matrix. The things that are real in the Hermitian matrix, the real components of the Hermitian matrix, turn into phase changes of the unitary matrix. So a real component of the Hermitian matrix leads to a phase rotation symmetry, which lets you remove a phase, which is sort of the opposite of what you want it to be. But there's an I in the formula, so there's no way around it. So if we look at these Hermitian matrices, right, we know that if we specify a real number for each diagonal entry and a complex number, some real plus imaginary number, in the upper triangle, that's fully specifying the Hermitian matrix, right? Now I can, the fact that these are real is required by hermeticity, and then these guys are going to be just the complex conjugates of their upper triangular partners. So a Hermitian matrix is specified by 6 real and 3 imaginary parameters, which means once I use e to the ih, that it removes 6 phases. If it were broken, it would remove 6 phases and 3 real parameters. Okay, so I just swapped the two. The real chain remove phases, the imaginary remove real parameters. Now, of course, I'm not breaking the whole U3 and the whole U3. I have surviving a U1 cubed. My U1 cubed has, so these three, so this we just worked out, would remove 6 phases and 3 real. I'll call my phases phi. This removes 6 phases and 3 real. But the U1 cubed, each one of those U1s, it's specified by a real parameter. It generates a phase rotation, right? I just wrote the phase rotations up there, parametrized by the alphas. So this is 3 phases. That means in my symmetry breaking, I am breaking a total of 12 minus 3 rephasing symmetries. And 6 real rotations. So that's 9. I have 9 broken rephasings. That means I can get rid of every single phase over here. I have 6 real rotations, so I can get rid of all but 3 real numbers. So the math works out at the level of real and imaginary as well. And this is exactly the way it works for the leptons, because for the leptons, I just have, basically after, if I think about the G2 breaking first, so I just have 2 U3s, that I break those U3s with the Yukawas, and I get 1 U1 cubed. And that's exactly the math that I just did. That's the full story for the leptons. It's not the full story for the quarks, because for the quarks, I still have to add the down Yukawas. And I have to add the down U3s. So that's what we're going to do next. But first, just to remind you, so we have this operator. There were a few operators that we decided were interesting last time. So these are just some examples. So one was this S bar left sigma mu d left squared. Another one was, say, you write conjugate. One with three electrons. Okay, this guy, we've now broken all of the electron symmetries, and we see that he's still there's still a U1 mu. It's part of that U1 cubed, under which this has a charge because it has one muon in it. Has a charge one, which is not equal to zero. Which means that it's not in the standard model Lagrangian. Here, whether I had broken the up first or the down first, I would still have a U1S associated with just rephasing the strange quarks. This has a U1S charge of minus 2, which is not equal to 0. So this is not in the standard model yet. What I'm about to do, adding both Yukawas simultaneously, will break this symmetry. And then we won't be able to argue that this isn't in the standard model. But up to now, there's no term that involves only y up and g2, or only y down in G2 that could ever generate this structure.
So what is U1S?
Sorry. So this is a U1 that transforms just the strange quarks. So in analogy with these phases here, right, I could call that middle guy U1C. And the top guy U1U, because there were three U1s left over by the upbreaking.
So for the down, you have.
But if I just broke the down, I'd have three U1s associated with each down type quark. Okay? So writing out each case separately just would have been, yeah.
And the other thing is that in the diagram, you could have broken it in the arrows could have gone a little bit differently, right?
So for example, I could have broken up, in the diagram what I drew is the down Yukawas and is what happens when you break the down Yukawas, yeah. and add charged currents. The thing that I derived on this board was the opposite case. What happens when you add up type Yukawas and G2s? So now we see what happens when you put the three together. Up, down Yukawas and G2s. So at that point, I could try to do the same thing, right? Well, let me put it this way. Suppose I take away G2. This is actually what we do, right? The masses of particles are something that we don't want to be just including in perturbation theory. We work with massive eigenstates. So really what we do is we start out thinking about y up and y down. And then we ask what symmetries are left when we add y up and y down. Then we're going to break G2. Because we can always add W's in perturbation theory. They're going to have small effects, they're heavy, etc. Whereas the masses, we want to work with mass eigenstates. So that motivates first asking what happens when you break y up and y down simultaneously. Well, up there on the top board, y up and y down, the VEV parts, the mass parts, just broke down two totally separate pairs of U3s, right? So I showed you how I can go to the up eigenstate, mass eigenstate basis. I can go to the down mass eigenstate basis too. I've turned off G2. There's nothing connecting the up lefts to the down lefts. So this just breaks my U3 to the fourth, all the quarks, I'm not going to write them down separately. Down to a product of two U of U1 cubed. my U1 cubed up cross U1 cubed down. These are the up mass eigenstates. These are the down mass eigenstates. Now, in this basis, in my original basis, before I chose mass eigenstates, in my original basis, I had, now we're going to look at what G2 looks like in this basis. So I've got my coupling of a W plus to a U left bar. Sigma bar mu, d left j, and since these are charged under different groups, I'm going to go ahead and remind myself that there's a matrix in between them, delta ij. Okay, it's an identity matrix, but they transform differently. If I do this change of basis for the ups, and I do a change of basis for the downs, this isn't going to be the identity matrix anymore. Right, so I'm taking, I want to write it in terms of my mass eigenstates, u tilde left, which was equal to v dagger u left. That means that u left bar, well, so u left would be equal to v u tilde. U left bar is U tilde left bar V dagger. My D lefts, I want to write in terms of a D left tilde, which is exactly the same thing, except the V has a different label, and it's a different matrix. V D left dagger D left, which means that D left is equal to V D left. D left tilde. So I can plug these in, write this weak interaction in terms of my mass eigenstates, and what I'm left with is a G2, this is plus his Hermitian conjugate, W plus U left bar tilde, U left tilde bar, times V dagger up, going to drop the L's because I'm only dealing with left-handed matrix, the L matrices here, times my matrix delta, times for my D left, I have a VD, and then I've got my sigma bar mu D left tilde. Does this make sense? Yeah.
So this comes from the covariant derivative?
Right. So this comes from the covariant derivative. And I guess we should have an upper index. So if usually we write this as part of the covariant derivative, we can always separate it out if we want to. So this is what we're left with. This is a matrix that naturally connects an up-type anti-quark to a down-type quark. So if I want to, I can think about this under as actually a, and often we do this, we think about how does this matrix transform under those U3s to the fourth. And we'd say this has a U3, I know you can't really see this, but it's also not that essential. A U3 on the up left, for that, it's a fundamental, right? It's a 3 of that. It can contract with, we say an anti-quark's in the anti-fundamental of their flavor group. So it's in the fundamental, in the three representation. And then it's a three bar of the D lefts. So this is a matrix that relates up-type quarks to down-type quarks. That's the main important point here. And that object is what we usually call the CKM matrix. Well, not quite. Sorry. So now this, in general, I haven't used any of my U1 cubed symmetries, right? I had two U1 cubes left over, and I haven't used them. I just chose my mass eigenstate basis, plugged that in, and so I get a V, which is almost the CKM matrix, which is V U dagger delta VD. This looks like a pretty ordinary, it's just the product of two unitary matrices. So it should be unitary, but otherwise I'm constrained. This is a unitary matrix. So we did the math of unitary matrices over there. Unitary matrices involve six phases plus three real numbers. And then, of course, I've also gone into mass eigenstate basis. I also have three up masses. They aren't contained in V. They're separate information that I have. Three up-type masses and three down-type masses. Now, if you ask how those U1 cubed cross U1 cubes act on this V, most of them act non-trivially. Right? The only thing, there's one thing I can do. So this is some generic unitary matrix. So for example, I can use those to change the phases of my to change some of these six phases to get rid of them. I could do one of my U1 U's appropriate, right? This unitary matrix, it has three phases on the diagonal. Plus it has other stuff here. I could certainly do U1 U rotations on the left to just remove each of those phases. Right? I would move phases around over here, but I could certainly do that. And I have three more U1s that I can use cleverly to get rid of more phases. But to figure out how many phases I can get rid of, I need to ask, are there any of those U1s that leave this matrix invariant? Because those will not be broken symmetries. That means I can't use them to remove phases. They don't change V at all, so I can't use them to remove a phase from V. And there's one unbroken U1. It's the one that just rephases every single up quark and every single down quark the same way, right? If I multiply just an overall phase, e to the I alpha times V times e to the minus I alpha, I'm just going to get V. This is a real number. It commutes through. So that one unbroken U1, I can identify with baryon number. It's the symmetry under which every quark has the same charge. And what that means is that I have five broken U1s. which I can use to remove five phases. And then that's all the symmetries I had at my disposal, right? It was just those 61s, one of which is unbroken. So what I'm left with, I started with six phases plus three reals in V. So this is all V. The masses are separate information that I've already gotten from the Y up and Y down breaking. What this leaves me with is one phase and three real numbers. Now, I could make different choices of where I want this phase to live. What exactly, this is in VCKM. And then I have plus my six masses. And that's the invariant content that I've left with from the Yukawas and the weak interactions. I could choose, for example, what element I want to put that phase in by doing different U1 rotations. So the exact form of this VCKM is a convention. But the content, the fact that it has one phase and three real numbers involved, that's an invariant notion. So the usual parametrization of VCKM, well, there are many different parametrizations. And there's sort of one standard convention for where the phase lives, but different ways of writing it out. So Mark wrote this down. I'm going to use the same form as he did. You may already have it in your notes from his class. But, and I'm also only going to do the upper triangular part because the other entries are just a lot messier. So you've got these three real numbers you could think of as mixing angles. Theta 1, 2, so we're mixing between the first two generations, theta 1, 3, and theta 2, 3, that are parametrizing mixing between the first, second, and third generations. You can build three rotation build the CKM matrix out of a product of three rotation matrices with different orientations, plus one rephasing matrix, and that's how you get this form that I'm about to write down. Partially. Minus, and then this middle term has a bunch of other terms. And then there's some other stuff down here, which makes it unitary. These are more complicated expressions, which is why I'm not writing them down. Now, if you take a small angle approximation, you were to linearize this in all the angles, that would give you one, theta 1, 2, theta 1, 3, e to the minus I delta, theta 2, 3, then these are 1. And then at the linear approximation, these are just what you'd expect. Okay, so this is the linearized approximation, which shows you that in the small angle limit, you can really think about these thetas as parametrizing what you want them to parametrize. So it's basically how different are the up mass eigenstates from the down mass eigenstates. And rather remarkably, they come from very different physics. They come from two totally separate generic Yukawa matrices. But rather remarkably, these angles are all relatively small. So theta 1, 2 is around 0.2. Theta 2, 3 think is around 0.1-ish, a little smaller, and theta 1.3 is smaller still, I think 10 to the minus, I think it's like around 0.01, very, very roughly. There are, of course, much higher precision numbers in the PDG. This is a rather hierarchical structure. Of course, the masses are also very hierarchical. So the physics of these Yukawa matrices is definitely kind of surprising, right? It's like the three generations, to some approximation, really came from different places, or somehow the up and down have some common origin, the top and bottom have some common origin that helps align their Yukawas. Right? This doesn't look totally random. All right, so how does all of this help us actually say some non-trivial things about physics, as opposed to just calculating mass eigenstates? Well, this symmetry turns out to be really important. So now, just to follow up on what I was saying earlier, I broke that U1s symmetry, right? I had six U1s. I broke them to just this baryon number. That's it. If you ask now with just a U1 baryon number symmetry, what's the charge of that operator under U1 baryon? Well, it has two quarks and two antiquarks. So it has baryon number 0. Once I've added, that means once I've broken the symmetry down to U1 baryon, there's no symmetry that forbids that operator from appearing in my Lagrangian. So it should appear. It should be generated in the standard model. The amount that's generated is controlled by this full symmetry breaking pattern. Of this U3 to the fourth, the ones involving quarks, down to a single U1. Baryon number, which involved G2, the charged part specifically, the Y up, and the Y down. All three of these have to be incorporated. The Y down, we're sort of using for free. I mean, we're talking about a strange quark and a down quark, right? We're talking about an operator in terms of mass eigenstates here. We already used Y down to define what operator we're interested in. So we don't necessarily expect to need to put that information in anymore in the Feynman diagram, where somehow any process that generates that operator has to have explicit G2s and Y-ups in the process that generates it. So first, though, let me connect that operator, tell you why it's interesting. What physics does it induce that we can actually see? So in the tutorial, you looked at KK bar mixing. And the kaon we can think of as a DS bar bound state, the anti-kaon as an SD bar bound state. That S bar left, sorry, let me start with D left as an operator, it has a creation operator and an annihilation operator. It creates left-handed down quarks. It annihilates right-handed antiquarks. S left bar, it's a conjugated operator, so it does the opposite. It creates right-handed S bar antiquarks and it annihilates left-handed strange quarks. So when we look at the operator S bar left, and I can now Fierce it to S bar left. Well, I won't do that. I could Fierce it to this form using sigma matrix identities, but I don't have to. I actually want to keep writing it in the old way as S bar sigma bar mu d left. S bar sigma bar mu d left. If I have an initial state k naught bar, it has an S quark, it has a d antiquark. Both of those are annihilated by one copy of this operator. The other copy of the operator can create an S bar and a D. That's creating a kaon. So I would expect that that the matrix element between a K naught bar and a kaon is not equal to zero. Now, what is it? So what is this going to do? This matrix element is not equal to zero. This is what one of the things you did in the tutorial. That's going to lead to kaon mass mixing. And that's been measured. And it's a system that can be studied with great precision. So we want to know how much kaon mass mixing does this actually lead to. There's a simple way of getting an order one estimate, which is called the vacuum insertion approximation. Okay, that just means, you know, clearly if I the kind of thing matrix element that I do know how to calculate, I can insert the unit, I can write this out as two separate copies and insert the identity matrix inside of them. Right? So this is equal, strictly equal to K naught S bar left, sigma bar mu, d left, sum over states x. Right? I can just insert the identity into any matrix element. Basic quantum mechanics. The vacuum insertion approximation is the approximation that an order one estimate to this quantity can be obtained just by including the piece from x being the vacuum. And this sort of makes sense. At the parton level, the kaon contains a strange quark, a down quark, and nothing else. So in that idealization, what you'd be left with should mostly over after say annihilating these states in the kaon state, should have most overlap with the vacuum. Of course, you could think of the kaon as having all kinds of other partons in it as well, and it would have non-zero overlap with other states. But the approximation is to just take the vacuum piece. So if I approximate that by this, you might or might not remember these kinds of matrix elements from when you were doing pions. So this is one of the standard objects that you work with. I mean, usually we did the U bar D for the pion. This is the standard current that sources the pion field from the vacuum. This is equal to, up to some i's, this is just equal to this factor f, right, the pi on decay constant, or in this case, the k on decay constant, which is just a property of your chiral Lagrangian, times p mu, where p is the momentum of this kaon. And of course, to get a non-zero matrix element, this kaon had better have the same momentum p. This is also just equal to fk times p mu, upper index. And then you know that p squared should be equal to the mass of the kaon. So in this approximation, that matrix element would just be equal to f kaon squared times m kaon squared. Now, delta m over m, this matrix element, this controlled says mass dimension 2, right? This is equal to basically m kaon times delta m, the mass splitting of the two eigenstates. So delta m over m kaon is equal to, if I have a Lagrangian that has a 1 over lambda squared times s bar left, sigma bar mu d left squared, that shouldn't be on that line. Delta m kaon over m kaon is equal to 1 over m kaon squared times the expectation value of your interaction Hamiltonian, which just has exactly that same coefficient. Right? So this should follow from what you did last time. Now, plugging in the above, I'm going to get a 1 over lambda squared times my 1 over m kaon squared prefactor times that expectation value, which I just estimated, to be f kaon squared times m kaon squared. Okay, those kaon masses cancel. And since I made an approximation there, I can put in an order 1 number. So this is the way it's usually done. We usually say it's equal to that with a factor of b, and b is an order 1 parameter whose value we don't know. There are various ways of trying to estimate b more precisely, but there's still some uncertainty here. That gives us delta m kaon over m kaon equal to b times fk squared over lambda squared. And we've measured that to be 10 to the minus 14. So the delta m, the mass splitting, is about 10 to the minus 12. I think 4 times 10 to the minus 12 MeV. The mass is around 500 MeV. So you take the ratio, you get 10 to the minus 12. This is a very fortuitous mass splitting because the oscillation length that it gives you is a nice macroscopic distance. You can do experiments running kaons through material, and the kaons actually see the material. So this is a very convenient system for experimentation. It's also very nice that because this mass difference is small, and fk is about 100 MeV, that means that what this mass difference is probing is it's probing lambda of order 10 to the 7 times f kaon, which is around 10 to the 6 GeV. That's, of course, much larger than mw squared. So this is actually what the standard model gives us. I'll go through the symmetry arguments next time based on what I did up there. to show that indeed in the standard model, you get a contribution around this order of magnitude. Now, the standard model term has easy to calculate pieces and hard to calculate pieces that are all of the same order of magnitude. I'm, of course, going to do just the easy part. So there's significant uncertainty in the final number. But this is the right order of magnitude. It's consistent with observation. That leaves you with a very tight constraint on the scale of corrections from new physics. So next time, I'll try to do both the standard model using these symmetry arguments and then sketch out how beyond the standard model physics can give you much larger contributions. See how this works out into a very powerful constraint. All right, sorry for running a few minutes over. Do any of you guys have questions?